You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the sparkling water selection in the grocery store has become much larger, and it might be in part because people are turning away more and more from soda over the years. We'll hear more from a reporter. First, diagnosed cases of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, are on the rise in America. That's according to a new study published last week in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which found that ADHD rates among U.S. kids jumped substantially in the past 20 years. While boys are still more likely to be diagnosed, the study also found that the prevalence of the disorder among girls has gone up. Researchers also noted that Black and Hispanic children are being diagnosed with ADHD at higher rates than in the past. Dr. Patrick Remington joins us now to talk more about this latest ADHD data. He's a professor and associate dean of public health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here, Rob.
Well, whenever I see numbers like this, I wonder, does this mean more kids have ADHD or we're getting better at diagnosing ADHD?
Or both.
Okay.
We don't really know. ADHD, as you know, or ADD, attention deficit disorder, falls into the category of a condition that does not have a blood test. It does not have a specific diagnosis. It relies on a number of characteristics of children, and it relies on a clinician making the diagnosis. And so it could be that the increase from about 6% to 10% in 2016, 10% of kids ages 4 to 17. It could be that that's entirely due to changes in diagnosis and in patients' awareness of the condition, or it could be that some portion of that is an actual increase in the underlying condition itself.
Now, let's talk about ADD and ADHD. Just briefly, what are they? What do we mean when we use those terms?
Well, again, there's a standard definition in what we call the DSM, the fifth version of that, where there are specific criteria that clinicians use to diagnose it. Basically, it has to do with the term itself, attention deficit. Kids tend to be impulsive, can tend to have trouble concentrating and focusing, but it's often diagnosed not with attention to those specific criteria, but more in a general clinical sense. So it could be diagnosed by a pediatrician or a primary care provider. It may not be diagnosed by somebody who specializes and uses those exact criteria.
And what treatments, what treatment options are there once we have that diagnosis?
Well, there are a number of treatment options from behavioral counseling to things that parents and children can do with regimen at home and in school. It can also be treated with medicine. And that depends really on a conversation between the provider, the parent, and the child. Oftentimes, children in their teens will be involved in that treatment decision. And so it's not necessarily treated with medicine, but oftentimes it does end up that people try other means and the parents or the child is frustrated with their ability to focus, with their ability to sit still in class, and so that medicine is often the resorted to.
There are arguments sometimes that ADD is overdiagnosed, that medications are overprescribed, that this is just kids being put in kind of an unnatural situation where they're supposed to sit still all day. The problem isn't necessarily the kid. It's the environment that they're in. The authors of the new study don't seem to think that's the problem. What do you think?
I think it could be a factor. The environment is changing. We know there's an obesity epidemic, and that didn't happen just overnight. It didn't happen by changing biology or genetics. The environment changed, and those things that lead to obesity in kids could also lead to the expression of a tendency towards attention deficit. For example, spending more time in a seat, less physical activity, changes in diet could even affect mental health. So I think the evidence is certainly that all of these factors are to play, but I think there's a good evidence that the environment that kids live in, their school and home environment, especially the food and physical activity environment, has changed, and that could contribute to and not an increase in sort of the biologic tendency, but in the expression of that biologic tendency that a kid could have.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at an increase over the last couple decades from about 6% to about 10% in diagnosis of ADHD among American kids and adolescents. So what do we do to bring that number down? Assuming, or I don't know, maybe we don't want to bring it down. Maybe we're happy we're finding kids with ADHD and are able to treat them. What do you think?
Well, I think there are several implications of the study. First is to continue to do a better job of surveillance. This study is done annually. It's the Health National Health Interview Survey, and they ask parents whether their child has ever been diagnosed with ADHD or ADD. So this is a question of a parent referring to what a doctor or provider may have said. I think it would be better to have more objective measures of actual objective measures in surveillance. So we need better data. The second issue is that it calls into attention the need for better treatment, that these kids should be cared for by a primary care provider and somebody who pays attention to the diagnosis. And again, I think people would argue that there, just as with autism, there's a spectrum from kids who clearly have ADHD fully expressed and are not able to cope in a learning environment, to those who are expressing a bit of energy and resistance to having to sit in a chair for long periods of time. There's good evidence that if we change the learning environment, provide more physical activity, more active learning environments, that those kids can be really better off simply by changing the learning environment.
And one change in ADHD over the years, according to the report, is in demographics. I think if you had a poster child for ADHD 20 years ago, it would be white and male. This report is finding more reports of ADHD diagnosis for girls and for children of color.
Well, it's the relative increase. So, boys went up, but relatively didn't go up as much as girls and kids of color. And so the relative increase has been greater in that group, but they're still much less likely to be diagnosed. And again, one of the things, if a kid is exhibiting unruly behavior in school and it happens to be a white boy, you may be more inclined to blame ADD or ADHD than if it were a young girl or a person of color. And again, that's nothing to say that there isn't underlying similarity in the condition, but in our likelihood to diagnose it, we may be patterned to say that young boys have that as a diagnosis and less likely to do that with young girls. The same thing in heart attacks. Women often present with symptoms of heart attacks. They're slightly different, but clinicians may not think that this is a heart attack if it's a woman. They may not think that it's ADD if it's a young girl or a person of color.
Can you talk about healthcare access as it relates to diagnosis and treatment of ADHD?
Well, again, it's important that these conditions are addressed in total, in the school setting, because this is often where the symptoms become a concern for teachers, with the family, because this is not a condition that simply needs to be treated with a medicine. It's a family that comes to in the treatment setting, and it's also a pediatrician or a family medicine doctor or a trained psychologist. So it's really a team approach in understanding the problem. Is this a concern with the setting that the child is in, or is it really a behavior problem that needs to be addressed? And then treatments are done similarly with a team approach.
Now, you mentioned this is all based on this annual report, self-reported, basically, as you say, by families. What would you like to see in the public health community when it comes to monitoring this, so we have a better idea of what's really going on with ADHD?
Well, again, I think the in-person objective studies that are done, we do a study called the Survey of Health of Wisconsin, where we go and measure people in person. Those type of studies get objective measures. Same with autism, that we can rely on parents' reports or provider reports, but I think more research and better surveillance with objective measures. They're more expensive, but we can do smaller studies to monitor those conditions more objectively over time. And whether or not this is truly increasing or simply increasing in parent reports, it is a public health issue. 1 out of 10 kids is exhibiting a behavior that makes learning harder in the school setting. And so we need to address it. But I think we tend as a society to go to quick fixes and medicine can be perceived as a quick fix, and that doesn't solve the underlying problem. The environment that the kid's in, at home or at school, could be a cofactor in why these symptoms are being exhibited. So I think we need to consider it, as we do all public health problems, with a comprehensive approach.
Dr. Remington, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Patrick Remington's a professor and associate dean of public health at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us to talk about the latest data on ADHD, in America. Sales for sugary soda brands have been on a slow decline for the last few decades. In the late 90s, Americans were consuming over 50 gallons of soda per year per person. In 2016, it looks like that dropped to about 38.5 gallons. Still sounds like a lot. We've seen sales in sparkling waters and bottled waters increase. And last month, PepsiCo bought SodaStream, a product that lets users make and customize their own carbonated water at home. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you drink a lot of soda, or have you made an effort to cut back over the years? What are you drinking instead? Have you jumped on the sparkling water bandwagon? It's hip in the hip places. What do you like about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Beth Coit is a senior writer at Fortune Magazine covering food, consumer behavior, and women in business. Beth, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Beth, are you seeing this in numbers or anecdotally, a decline in how much soda we're drinking?
Definitely. I think we've seen a mass, you noted this in your intro, but I think over the last three decades, consumers have really backed off soda, and a large part of it is health-related. You know, we do have an obesity crisis in this country, and I think one way people are trying to manage their weight is cut back on calories and cut back on soda.
So if we're cutting back on sugary soda, are we moving to diet colas and things like that, or are those going down too?
So this is a really interesting phenomenon. So not only are we seeing a decline in regular soda sales, consumers say actually that sugar is the number one thing they're trying to avoid, but we're actually, the category of soda that's seeing the steepest declines has been diet historically. And one of the reasons is that we're wary of artificial sweeteners. So we don't really understand what they are. We're not sure what they're doing to us, and for that reason, we're sort of turning our back and saying, okay, if I am going to drink soda, perhaps I'm just going to drink the real thing.
Well, here we go. We heard from Kevin on our Facebook page. Kevin says he quit drinking soda many years ago. He says there's too many calories in regular soda and too many chemicals in diet soda.
So Kevin is on the
bandwagon, huh?
That pretty much encapsulates the issue.
So who is winning? What are we buying instead if we're not putting as much money into Coke, Pepsi, RC, you name it?
So very simply, water. That is a huge, it's kind of an interesting phenomenon. We're seeing a real massive growth in bottled water sales, in particular sparkling and bubbly water. This has been a big area where a lot of soda companies have invested a lot of money. They think that this is the future. Consumers are, they're still going to drink something. So it seems so far that it's going to be the sparkling category. We've seen some growth in beverages like kombucha as well, but definitely not at the same scale as sparkling and still water.
Now, I've heard anecdotally that sparkling waters like LaCroix from here in Wisconsin and some others, they're getting big, and hipsters in Brooklyn and other places are getting on board. Is that reflected in sales? Are those sparkling waters really going up to that extent?
Yeah, hugely so. I mean, I can report from New York that we also LaCroix is also very popular here. Definitely has sort of a millennial hipster appeal to it, but we're seeing, you know, Pepsi has launched its own brand of sparkling water called Bubbly. Nestle has a line. Coca-Cola recently acquired a brand in the sparkling water category. So everyone is really trying to get in because this is where the growth is.
I don't know how much data we have generationally on who's drinking what, but if I can capture all the headlines of recent years, are millennials killing soda?
I mean, we're killing everything. I am a cusper, so I am somewhat of a millennial. And yes, apparently we are killing all major trends, so including soda consumption. I would say that's true. I think a younger generation in particular is driving a lot of the shifts that we're seeing around health and wellness, want to eat differently from maybe their parents' generation, don't want processed foods. We've seen how that's playing out in a real way in the grocery store, and I think it's definitely what's happening in soda too.
Yeah, I feel like, Beth, for years we've known what is bad for us, soda, super fatty, high calorie food. Yet people keep going to restaurants and buying those 1800 calorie appetizers, things like that. It seems like we can have the knowledge and ignore it. Is that changing? Are we actually changing our buying behaviors with health in mind?
So I think there is something to that. I think that we are changing our behaviors, particularly maybe less so in the restaurant environment, but definitely when it comes to the store. We've seen a real push toward the perimeter of the supermarket, where the fresh, unprocessed goods are. This is where big food companies want to have their products now, because this is where we're spending most of our time as shoppers. We're not spending nearly as many dollars in those center aisles of the store where the processed goods are. We're concerned about that. So we really are. We're shifting our dollars. It's really happening. And I think soda companies, beverage companies, food companies in general are struggling to figure out how to respond.
Beth Kowitt is with us from Fortune Magazine, talking about a decline in soda sales and consumption and what's replacing it in the beverage industry and how thoughts about health are affecting what we eat and drink. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed your soda habits? We heard from Kyle on Facebook. Kyle says he stopped drinking soda after his nurse showed him how much sugar was in it. Now he's drinking carbonated flavored water. There it is again. Which has no sugar, sodium, or artificial sweeteners. And Mike says he used to drink 3 to 4 bottles of Pepsi per day. In January of 2017, he had his last soda and now drinks only water. So we're hearing from some people, it's not just, I cut back. It sounds like cold turkey. Do you think a lot of people are doing this based on seeing how much sugar is there?
I think that's true. I mean, this goes back to what we were talking about in the beginning about how sugar is the number one thing that consumers are trying to avoid. Different ingredients have gone through waves of popularity, or I guess I could say waves of demonization as well. So right now, sugar is definitely the one that people are saying no to. And part of that is that there was a big move to add a line to nutritional labeling that would say how much added sugar was in a product. So, there's a difference, obviously, between natural sugars and something and what's been added on. And I think if that does happen, there's a question about whether it will. What will that do to people's habits if they read the label and see how, especially in something like soda, where clearly no natural sugars, it's all added. And I think that has the power to change how people eat and drink.
Let's bring on a caller. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I do have to say I do have my one can of soda a day. It's just a 12-ouncer. I don't drink coffee, so this is kind of my caffeine kick thing. But I do drink a lot of water. I drink about 16 to 20 ounces of water a day, so I kind of hopefully wash some of that bad stuff away.
Cindy, thanks a lot for calling. So way more water than soda. And I know, Beth, the health people have been telling us, hey, you want to drink something, water's probably the way to go. We're starting to listen now.
Yeah, juice sales we've also seen juice get hurt a little bit too. There's a lot of sugar in there as well. So I think that water is, and again, this goes to PepsiCo's recent deal for SodaStream. I mean, that is they're moving outside the bottle in a way. This is a product where you as a consumer add water to a glass or plastic bottle that's given to you, and you carbonate it yourself. So again, I think they are realizing that we are drinking more water, and how can they really tap into that major trend?
Cindy, thanks for that call. Matt is with us now in Madison. Matt, hi.
Hi. With our family, we haven't really outlawed soda, but we have tried to buy sodas that have cane sugar instead of corn sugar as the sweetener. So we still buy Coke, but it's Mexican Coke So it's bottled in Mexico with cane sugar, and then it comes up in bottles. But as an alternative, I switched to drinking black tea probably about 4 years ago. I lost about 20 pounds.
Wow.
I haven't cut out soda altogether because I still like a Coke every now and then or if we go out to eat or whatnot, but it's not a daily thing anymore. So daily is to wake up in the morning and my teenage daughter makes a pot of tea. And I take tea to work and some of the kids take tea to school. And so we've kind of shifted to we're still drinking a lot, but we're trying to drink things without calories but still have the caffeine.
Matt, thanks a lot for that call and sharing your story. And Beth, I want to key in on the tea issue. There are bottled teas on the market. Is that where some of the beverage companies are trying to go to make up for what they're losing on soda now?
Definitely. Bottled coffee, bottled tea, we've seen a lot of innovation come out of this area. This is not unique here in this particular case. I think that people are saying, again, this is a great I'm a coffee drinker. I'm not willing to give up my coffee. I want my caffeine. But how can we make it convenient? How can we really give you that ease of use that maybe just opening up a bottle or can of soda has? And I think that that's really where companies like Pepsi and Coke and some smaller upstarts are really trying to play.
And Beth, briefly, as we wrap up, soda sales are down. They're not out. We're not going to see them disappear from the grocery store shelves anytime soon, are we?
No, and I think that this conversation has really reflected that. People cutting back, but still occasionally want to treat themselves. So have a soda here and there, but are not consuming at the same levels that they once were.
Beth, thanks a lot for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Beth Kowitt is a senior writer at Fortune Magazine. We've been talking about declining sales in sugary sodas and diet sodas and what we're drinking instead. Wisconsin is finally getting a break from all the heavy rain from the past 2.5 weeks. The National Weather Service is forecasting cool, dry air for at least the next few days, but warns some rivers may run high and that additional flooding is still possible. Andrew Beckett is the Assistant Public Information Officer with Wisconsin Emergency Management. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us.
Happy to be here, Rob.
Well, we're not quite out of the woods yet, it sounds like, when it comes to flooding. Where are you watching for problems?
We continue to watch a number of the rivers around the state that have just had a lot of water flow into them. You know, the Baraboo River continues to rise or has crested recently, only recently at some areas along its course. Same with the Kickapoo River. We have a number of communities along those rivers, Biola, Reedstown, Gays Mills, Steuben, Rock Springs, Baraboo itself, all have the rivers above flood stage at this point. So those are some of our areas of largest concern, is at least in terms of the immediate threat to public safety at this time.
Now, we've been knocked around by rain for a couple weeks now. Do we have any idea when water levels are going to get low enough to where we're back to something like normal?
Well, it's going to take a while for those rivers to recede, especially the Baraboo and the Kickapoo, which in some cases have been above record flood levels. So, you know, it may be another week, assuming we continue to see dry forecasts in our future, that we begin to see water levels kind of get back down to their pre-flood event levels.
I know we've got some schools holding off on opening day around the state. Can you take a look around at roads and highways? Do we have any closures still going on because of the flooding and or the damage that came from it?
There are a number of closures on state highways in many of the counties that have been affected throughout Southwest, West Central, and Southern Wisconsin. I mean, the most important resource that people can rely on is the 511wi.gov. That is a full list of many of the road closures around the state. And also check with county highway departments for road closures that might be in effect in your area. I mean, some of the major ones that we're seeing include some partial lane closures along 9094 and 39, kind of in the Portage area where there's concerns about the rising river levels. We've got National Guardsmen who are out there right now doing some sandbagging operations to prevent the risk of water on the roadways. And the lane closures there are mostly for the safety purpose of those members of the Guard who have been doing those operations.
And now, as things are drying out, and I know we're still dealing with flooding in some places, but for your department, what are some of the key priorities now as we start to clean up from this?
Well, as we've said, we still have water up in some areas, but in other areas where the waters have receded, you know, we've begun the effort of working with local officials to start doing damage assessments and get an idea of what kind of devastation was done by these flooding events. And we'll begin, or we'll work to collect that information here in the weeks ahead as we kind of total up what's been happening statewide.
And Andrew, as we wrap up, now that people have flooding on their minds, do you have any messages out there from the emergency management standpoint for people to maybe be prepared for when it happens again, the next flood we see in Wisconsin?
Well, preparation always starts well in advance of any threat actually even being out there. I mean, for individuals whose homes may be at risk of flooding, it's very important to make sure that any vital documents, treasured keepsakes, aren't stored in your basement. And if they are, make sure they're in watertight containers. Assess the drainage around your home. I mean, a lot of people may not have had river levels rise up to them, but there might have been drainage issues that contributed to problems with water entering their basements. So it's important to kind of assess those risks now before you face a problem again in the future. And if you did have damage during the recent flooding, make sure you're calling 211 and reporting it. That service is collecting damage estimates in many counties around the state, which will be given to local officials, which will in turn help the state get an accurate picture of how much damage was done statewide.
Andrew, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Always happy to be here.
Andrew Beckett is the Assistant Public Information Officer for Wisconsin Emergency Management. We talked with him about the ongoing flooding threat in parts of the state and recovery where the waters have started to recede. Now, speculation is all over the place about which official in the Trump administration wrote a scathing op-ed about the president in yesterday's New York Times. The anonymous piece was titled, "I Am Part of the Resistance Inside the Trump Administration." The author says while he or she and other like-minded individuals support many of the president's policies and want him to succeed, he's going about them all wrong. The op-ed says Trump is amoral, that meetings with him veer off topic, and that he engages in repetitive rants. Even says there have been whispers of invoking the 25th Amendment, which would begin a process of removing the president. President Trump reacted to that piece yesterday at the White House.
If the failing New York Times has an anonymous editorial, can you believe it? Anonymous. Meaning gutless, a gutless editorial. We're doing a great job. The poll numbers are through the roof. Our poll numbers are great. And guess what? Nobody is going to come close to beating me in 2020.
A New York Times spokesperson defended running the op-ed, saying it adds, quote, significant value to the public's understanding of what's going on in the Trump administration, end quote, from someone on the inside. Kathleen Searles is an assistant professor of political communication at Louisiana State University. She studies the news media, political psychology, partisan news, and poll coverage. Katie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, this isn't something you see every day. How big a deal do you see this story as being?
It certainly seems like this is a historic moment. Certainly for those of us to study this is completely unprecedented. And as I'm sure you can imagine, political scientists everywhere are very much abuzz about who this might be, what this means, both as scholars, but also just as members of the public. We share many people's shock over this op-ed.
I want to look at the New York Times decision process here a little bit. I saw a quote from a former public editor at the New York Times saying, this is a great day to not be a public editor at the New York Times. What goes into a decision for a media outlet about whether to publish an anonymous op-ed like this?
Yeah, it's fascinating that they made this decision, although I would not say altogether surprising. The way I think about this is, you know, obviously the president is quite unhappy with the New York Times, which is not unexpected. But an outlet like this, whether you believe it to be liberal or not, has staked their reputation and their credibility, which is their stock and trade in this business, on publishing, vetted information, and we can all be pretty assured that they would not permit this to run if they thought at all that they could be attacked later on for letting something run that was not accurate. So I'm fairly certain that they've done their due diligence because they really don't need, you know, they're the New York Times. They don't need to publish this. They would not publish this if they didn't think, A, that it was informative for the public, and B, that it was credible.
I want to give a listen to New York Times op-ed editor James Dow in the Daily Podcast from the newspaper today, defending the paper's use of anonymity or keeping the writer's identity secret.
It was essentially a case of if this person would not be willing to use their real name because they perhaps wanted to remain in the administration to do what they're doing, as they did not want to lose their job or reputation or face whatever other kinds of consequences one might face in this situation, whether it might be physical threats or emotional stress. You know, out of that conversation, we decided that the peace was important enough and strong enough to justify granting anonymity.
And what do you think of that argument, Katie?
I agree. There's only been a handful of anonymous op-eds published in the New York Times before under certain circumstances in which the author could potentially be in danger. But often, and this is true for all outlets, we do see anonymous sources, and the historical comparison recently has been to Deep Throat. So what I think is really fascinating is that this person obviously feels like they have something they need to share that is of value to the public, but their choice to pen an op-ed rather than to, have somebody from the New York Times write up an expose is an interesting one and I think revealing. And some of the discussion about the language used suggests that this person's quite skilled and has done something like this before. So that gives us some indicator of who this might be, or at least some speculation fodder for who this might be.
Right. And in that speculation, they use the phrase senior administration official, and that could be a cabinet member who's a household name, or it could be a deputy something who we've never heard of. There's still a lot of wiggle room there, right?
Yeah, certainly it could be anyone. But I'm going to guess that given that this is the stature of this particular news outlet, that they would not publish just anyone. You know, I'm guessing that the New York Times is not going to have some, you know, nobody deputy. Not that they're not performing great public service, but they're not going to just have somebody that's on the lower end of the totem pole publish an op-ed that has this, that attracts this much of the public's attention. I'm fairly certain that we can be sure that whoever this is high up, and that they've gone thoroughly through the vetting process, and that the New York Times has decided internally that it is a safe bet for them to publish this.
I want to get into the content of this a little bit now. The argument is basically, I work for the Trump administration. I like a lot of what we've done, tax cuts, deregulation, things like that. The president is very problematic, this person says, and we've taken active steps to foil him, taking steps to stop him from implementing some of what he wants to do. What do you make of this, the content of this piece?
You know, it's very interesting, because if we think back through history of the sort of big, of anonymous sources who have exposed what they perceive as corruption or wrongdoing within powerful administrations, typically it's more cut and dry. They are exposing something that they believe is illegal or wrong. Here we have a person who believes, you know, there's morally wrong things being done in the administration, but that they are not so much telling the public that there's something the public needs to do or there's some sort of action we need to take. It's more of a effort to say, hey, you guys, you know, we've got it covered. So it's entirely bizarre that they are not only saying that they are worried about the president and what the president is doing, but at the same time saying, but, you know, we've got it covered, so don't worry too much.
We're talking about the op-ed piece released yesterday by the New York Times, attributed to an anonymous senior Trump administration official. The writer claims he or she is part of a group in the White House deeply troubled by, they say, Trump's instability and temperament. Kathleen Searles is our guest, assistant professor of political communication at Louisiana State University. You can join in at 800-642-1233. What do you think of this opinion piece? Was the New York Times right to publish it, or was it gutless, as President Trump called it? How much weight do you put on an anonymous source like this? How important is it to you to know who wrote it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. So we continue our conversation about the New York Times piece written by an unnamed senior official in the Trump administration. Katie Searles is our guest, assistant professor of political communication at Louisiana State University. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. Was the New York Times right to run this piece and to run it anonymously? Is it okay to keep the name secret? Or should the author have had to reveal their identity? What do you think this says about what's going on in the White House? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to a caller now. Marianne is with us in Gordon. Marianne, hi.
Hi. I can't believe I'm the first caller. Yes, my comment is this. I do read the New York Times on a very regular basis. I will never read it again. I cannot believe that they would print an article as critical of our president as this article and not put a name to it.
Marianne, thanks for the call. Kathleen, Marianne, probably not alone, the president himself, and I'm sure others not happy, and actually some critics of the president not wild about the anonymous publication here.
Yeah, I think that there is definitely room for a conversation to be had about whether or not, you know, this is a normatively desirable thing for the newspaper to do. And what I mean by that is, you know, if we think about the press as having a certain function in our democracy, what sort of behavior should they be engaging in? And this is definitely something that I can see critiques, the pertinent critiques as to whether or not they should engage in this. But I would also remind your listeners, and as I do my own students, that in the United States, our press is privately owned. They're profit-driven. So much of their behavior, whether we like it or not, is dictated by what kind of things people are going to read. And, you know, whether we think what the anonymous writer wrote is worthwhile of our attention or not, it's getting a lot of attention, and that's, at the end of the day, very good for business.
Marianne, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to John now in Windsor. John, hi.
Hi. You know, I'm very interested in the fact that people think that an anonymous person writing an editorial is something new in America. You know, Publius was an anonymous person who did the Federalist Papers. That turns out that was Madison and Jefferson. You know, Jefferson did anonymous news editorials in the Philadelphia paper when he was vice president criticizing Adams. This has been going on for a long time. I think this is great because it really gets to the point of what this person feels is going on, right or wrong, with the Trump administration.
John, thanks for the call. Kathleen, what do you think?
John's absolutely right, and that's a really great point regarding the Federalist Papers. And those turned out to be hugely instrumental. And I have to imagine, although, you know, it's hard to infer what the writer is thinking here, but a lot of the language is very moral. It's very high-minded. He references McCain at one point. It is possible that this writer sees him or herself as being a part of a very important and long history in the United States of exposing what is perceived to be a misuse of power. And so I think John's right on there.
Thanks for the call, John. Kent joins us now in Madison. Kent, hello.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I read the op-ed yesterday, and after some discussion, I'm a Democrat. I am definitely on the liberal end of the spectrum, but I think the op-ed is garbage. I think it's trying to lull people into a sense of complacency, like they're saying, hey, we got this under control at the White House. Don't worry. If you want to vote Republican, it's cool. We got this. I think people need to go out and vote in November and not listen to what maybe I don't know. It might be coming from the side they don't think that it's coming from. You know what I mean?
Kent, thanks a lot for the call. So he says, this could actually be something that helps Republicans in the elections. You hear bad stuff, but don't worry about it.
Yeah, I think it's fair to question the motives of the writer here. And I've been thinking about it a lot as well, Kent. And it's not straightforward, right? Because this person could, you know, come forward and probably would be a lot more of a credible voice on the matter. Also, when you read the op-ed, it's more of a critique of the president's being amoral and not perhaps not a good leader and erratic. There's not necessarily anything illegal that he's mentioning or any direct instances of abuse he or she is pointing out. So you do have to wonder what the motivations are here, and that only remains to be seen. Although the one thing that I think we'll all be watching, and I think that is very likely, is that this person will be outed at some point.
Thanks for that call, Kent. This is all coming amidst releases from the new Bob Woodward book, the expose, giving behind-the-scenes looks at the White House. Do you see a connection in theme or timing between the two?
I absolutely do. you know, I work at least partly in a comm school with a lot of people that their jobs are to help corporations brand and come up with communication strategies. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is that this is all happening at the same time. And from the outside, it perceives to be a coordinated attack. Not attack's a strong word, but at least a coordinated initiative, right? Pretty commonly, whenever there's any efforts at PR, that you'll have multiple sources, multiple outlets, multi-pronged communication strategies, and I can't help but think that this appears to be that sort of strategy, but we'll only know, I guess, in the coming days.
Let's go back to our callers. Colleen is on the line in Oshkosh. Colleen, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
I think that the person who wrote that is feeling guilty. I think that person is embarrassed. And I think that that person is trying to set himself or herself up as some kind of hero. And I don't see it that way.
Why not?
I don't see it that way because if things are not as they should be, then it shouldn't just be complaining in an op-ed, name or not. The person should be taking more action.
Colleen, thanks for that call. And now this is a criticism I've been seeing, Katie, from the left and from kind of never-Trump conservatives. Hey, put up or shut up, come out and put your name on this, and that would have way more impact. Do you think that's true?
I think that is true. But what's interesting, you know, to me as somebody that studies campaign strategy is that if you were a person that was working with the administration and maybe had objectives beyond the administration but was concerned about your legacy or your reputation, it would be smart strategically to put something like this out, wait for people to kind of demand for the person to step forward, and then come out like the hero. And then it's not that you are coming out of nowhere. It's that you kind of waited for people to ask you to come forward, and then you not only initiate the conversation and demand and shape the narrative in the way you want to, but then you still look like the hero when you finally do come forward.
Thanks for that call, Colleen. In our last few moments, Kathleen, do you think we're going to find out who this is in the short run?
I do think we will. I think these kind of things have a habit of not staying buried for very long, and particularly not today in the age of the Internet. I think that I'm going to guess that whoever penned this realized that that was part of the risk and is willing to accept that risk, and I would even hazard a bet that this person is going to voluntarily come forward at some point.
Do you have, and you don't have to share them, do you have any guesses or bets you would place on who it would be?
You know, I will tell you this much. My prediction is that it is a male, given the language and the parlance. And so that helps us at least narrow some down. And there has been certainly some fun speculation about the language use. The Lodestar references are compelling. But, you know, it's just anyone's guess.
Katie, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kathleen Searles is an assistant professor of political communication at Louisiana State University. We talked with her about the op-ed in yesterday's New York Times from an anonymous Trump administration official who claims to be one of several people working against the president on some issues from inside the White House. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a new report follows the money in an effort to change the rules on lead paint lawsuits here in Wisconsin. We'll get the details. The U.S. faces big threats in the world of cybersecurity. Is the nation ready? An expert tells us what the threats are. And it's Food Friday. We'll get recipes inspired by surfing. What does that mean? I don't know, but it sounds fun. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.